Hi, you're tuning in to One Year Review with me, Sinteung. Joining me on the show today is a very special guest, Mr. Brett King. He's the founder and executive chairman of Moven, which is a mobile challenger banking platform.
Correct.
Well, thank you for being on the show.
Brett
is here in Kuala Lumpur to speak at the PNB Corporate Summit. And Brett is also a renowned author. He has published a few books on the future of banking and is also widely regarded as a futurist. So I'd like to start with that. I'm sure you get asked this question a lot. Now, what exactly is a futurist, if you can explain to us?
We joke that being a futurist means never being wrong today. Because, you know, you don't find out if I'm wrong till later. But being a futurist is I think most futurists are generally optimists about the future. They want to get to the future as fast as possible. And so studying the trends that will impact us in the future, looking at human behavior, things that have happened in the past as analogies for how we'll respond to change, all of that's part of it. But essentially it's sort of mapping out those trends that we see emerging combined with lessons from history and human behavior to try and work out how mankind will respond to the challenges ahead.
Well, let's talk about those trends that you have identified about where the future is headed. Earlier, but during your presentation, you spoke about the pressure we will face from Industry 4.0, artificial intelligence,
Correct.
And robots taking over our jobs. Let's start with that. What are the key trends that you're seeing that will become the biggest threat to us?
There's four major disruptive forces. You can probably choose a couple of other influences on their future, but the first is obviously artificial intelligence. And so when we talk about robotics, particularly if a robot is autonomous, they're not remote controlled, then you know, you're essentially talking about that as a subset of AI. So a robot that has some autonomy because of artificial intelligence. So AI is sort of the number one disruptor. Everyone talks about that now, it's in the news, we hear a lot about it. The second disruptive theme is more around technologies that we'll see in the world around us or will be embedded. So if you think of the smartphone today as an analogy, in the future, you know, voice-based artificial intelligence, so we can talk to our home and our cars, and we have this speaker at home that will be able to turn the lights on and off and, you know, give us advice on various things. And then things like sensors that we'll wear on our body or in our clothes or maybe even ingest that will monitor our health. You know, that's all part of it. So that leads to the third disruptive theme, which is health tech. So gene therapy and, you know, combining AI with the way we treat medical conditions will create an incredible boon in healthcare. Longevity will probably be an outcome of it, but we'll be able to eliminate diseases from the human condition by editing our genome and will enhance or augment our humanity. You know, Elon Musk's working on chips that we'll be able to implant in our brain to compete with AI. And so the fourth theme sort of combines all of those elements, where we call it sort of smart infrastructure. How economies will compete in the future will be based on their level of intelligence and automation built into the economy. The same for companies. When you look at technology companies like the GAFAs, the FANGs, the BATXs, you know, they operate at a much higher level of efficiency in terms of profitability and productivity than traditional businesses, and that's a pattern for things to come. So that's the big four. You could throw in things like 3D printing and material science and things like that as well. Maybe space, you know, the commercialization of space travel and becoming a multi-planetary species, but sort of the big four, I choose those.
What are your thoughts about, you know, raising productivity when humankind are less needed? And this leads into, of course, other challenges that we will face, loss of jobs and things like that.
It's a big question. You know, at the heart of the question is two things. It's one is, if that wealth is captured by people that own the tech, then you get increased inequality. And so that's something we have to deal with. So we're thinking about mechanisms for that, like universal basic income and other things. But the bigger question really comes down to, if you know, we're really successful at deploying AI and we automate society, what will humans do? Because so much of what we do is defined by our work. You know, like if you meet someone in society and they ask, what do you do? You say, well, I'm actually a reporter, a journalist or whatever. And that sort of defines how people look at you. But if, you know, historically speaking, through like 99% of human history, we haven't done a 40-hour working week. You know, it's a fairly recent invention, if you like, of the Industrial Revolution. And so I don't think work will have the same place in our lives as humans in the future as it does today. So we have to sort of grapple with the change that automation brings to the place work has in society.
And do you think that, from your observation, speaking and traveling to so many different countries, are governments ready for it?
No, not at all. You could say the same for climate change as well. You know, we, as a species, we're not very good at long-term planning like mm-hmm. that. You know, the best we can do is sort of look 5 to 10 years out. When we start thinking about beyond that time frame, it sort of becomes almost abstract, and so it's not something we spend a lot of time thinking about or planning for. And yet, it's clear, like for example with climate shift, that we would have actually been a lot better off as a species had 50 years ago we started thinking about a way to phase out fossil fuels, for example. So one of the big problems we have is the way we look at economic value and growth is that's very short term, tends to be the next quarter or the next next year in terms of profitability. And so that focus tends to push us for much more shorter term goals. So how as a species we become more focused on solving these bigger problems over time, it's a real challenge.
But we are seeing some of the repercussions that will be amplified with climate change. For example,
correct.
In 30 years' time, you said 300 million people will
correct.
Be affected by rising sea levels. So these are very real threats, but we're just not thinking long-term enough.
And so, you know, if you look at immigration, you say, all right, by 2050, you know, we're talking about 300 million immigrants or migrants. How would you deal with that as a society? Today, in the current climate, you'd say, well, you know, we couldn't absorb that sort of immigration. But if we take a collective view as a species, then we'd have to say, well, why should those 300 million people be penalized for decisions humanity made in the past? And let's figure out a way to mitigate risk for those people. So the real question is sort of this us and them mm-hmm. view of the world. You know, we treat life like an Olympic sport sometimes. It's almost like, well, if I win and someone loses, that's fine because I got the benefit of it. But I'm hopeful that what the internet is producing in sort of fits and starts is a more social collectiveness where we, and I think our kids will be better at that. Our children maybe will be more socially conscious, socially aware. I hope that produces a more collective humanity approach to solving.
So what are your thoughts about rising nationalism, especially in the West?
Again, if you look at historical precedents for this, in 1968, Christmas Day, when the Apollo 8 astronauts circled the moon for the first time and took that Earthrise photo with the Earth coming up over the moon horizon. After that happened, the 1970s, you had the environmental awareness spike. You had environmental activities, Greenpeace coming out of it. All of these things that were a result of humanity looking at itself differently for the first mm-hmm. time, seeing the planet from space, not seeing borders and not seeing that. And that sort of consciousness was clear. So I think we need moments like that again, mm-hmm. where we say, you know, having geographical boundaries, having borders, having nationalism like we do, if you look at it from outer space, it's not a natural way we would organize humanity. And so it's sort of an arbitrary construct. So I think as we become more enlightened, I think we'll drop the borders, but we'll still have cultures that we respect or that we embrace. But I think the economic elements and immigration type stuff will eventually disappear.
Do you observe that any country is doing it right, in your point of view at the moment?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know if I can find someone that sort of stands out. I think Singapore did a pretty good job of it in the past. You know, Dubai and UAE is doing some interesting stuff now. But how do you create this economic activity by bringing in the right sort of immigration and stimulus, and then, training and teaching or educating your citizens as well as all part of it? I don't know. I don't know if there's anyone that really stands out. It's a good question. I haven't had that one before.
Well, we talk about a lot on technological intelligence, but perhaps not so much on social intelligence. Things like empathy, creativity,
right,
stewardship,
EQ
and things like that. And in your opinion, what are the areas that we should be looking at to go along together with this IR 4.0 AI, whatever tech?
Actually, the really interesting point of this is, as we start building this large systems design, you know, like autonomous transportation systems or medical systems based on AI and you know, massive sensor data, one of the things that we're starting to realize is that the way we manage the current system, often we have a lot of biases that come in, you know, gender bias, mm-hmm. racial bias, and so forth. And so we've sort of got this opportunity to redesign the system right now. Machine learning showing us that we can institutionalize those biases in code if we're not careful. So the real question is, how do we create machines that have high EQ, mm-hmm. not just IQ? And the question around ethics, how do we get machines that behave ethically, is a big question we haven't answered as yet.
Companies to behave ethically as well.
Yes.
If you look at the most powerful companies in the world right now are the likes of Facebook, Amazon, Alibaba, and they, if you talk about them dominating industries,
yeah.
and these are the things that discussions that we should be having right now.
And this is where you get this culture of leadership. Like, obviously, Mark Zuckerberg's facing a huge amount of criticism right now, but the culture he's created within Facebook has allowed that to occur. Jeff Bezos maybe, you know, is facing some similar questions. But you have someone like Yao Ma, Jack Ma, and it's a shame he sort of retired from Alibaba, but I think he's the type of leader and entrepreneur we need, big visionary. I like Elon Musk as well. I think he's the same in respect to that big idea things, you know. I think the culture of their organizations is not necessarily a template for the future. The big problem, I guess, you have with these billionaire entrepreneurs is to get to where they are, you have to be fairly ruthless as an entrepreneur to succeed. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is a bit of a problem, right?
So is there a sense that for you, this is tech companies becoming too big, too much control? Is that a trend that you're observing, and do you think it's something that we should be worried about?
So
and is there a sense of whether that we could control that
yeah.
in the future?
The biggest problem is capital markets reward that, right? Capital markets reward the economic performance of these tech companies because they're very productive, right? Very efficient. So if you take the GAFAs or the FANGs, in the US, or the Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, in China. These guys per employee generate massive returns. And so, you know, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, they generate between $500,000 and $1 million per employee in terms of net earnings annually. In the best years of the best industrials, the blue chips like GE or, you know, the banks, for example, mm-hmm. it was maybe $60,000 per employee. So that's why the market rewards these tech companies with these higher stock prices, because they're better at generating returns. And yet, in doing so, they're really sort of reinforcing an economic structure where you have less labor participation. So it's a very real structural issue in terms of the role capital markets have to play.
Well, let's talk a bit about capital markets and financial institutions. You wrote about the future of banking, and you look at where is the trend moving for banks, because the conversation amongst executives is they're being disrupted. They have woken up to that fact.
Correct.
But what is it that they are being disrupted? Is this just the technological systems? What about other things like mentality and corporate culture?
All of the above. But you know, the key problem starts is that if the way banks have been built over the last 600 years, you know, the oldest bank in the world today, Monte dei Paschi di Siena, 1472 it was founded. That was 8 years after the death of Cosimo Medici from the Medici Bank. And so really, the model of banking that we've had didn't change a lot between the 1400s in Italy and today. What sort of created some change was the introduction of technology, like mainframe computing and other technologies. But the basic bank account and how we used it had been defined by you go into a bank, you sign a piece of paper, and you get access to banking services. So we created this regulatory structure around that. But that resulted in some problems. Not everyone could get access to a bank account because they couldn't get to a branch. And so we thought, well, you need branches everywhere to have financial inclusion. But M-Pesa in Kenya and Paytm in India proved that actually the mobile phone's a better device for that than branches. So what it comes back to is that what does a bank do for you as a consumer? And it really provides you three core capabilities. The ability to safely store money, the ability to safely move money, whether you're in a store or sending money from person to person, and the ability to access credit when you don't have enough money to do something, like buy a home or a car or an iPhone in a store or a dress or something. And what we're finding with fintech is fintech is redefining that utility through the technology layer. And the way that's emerging doesn't fit the regulatory structure we have around licensing banks and so forth. For example, it may be that technology companies with large network effect, for example, like Alibaba and Amazon or our Tencent WeChat in China, they seem to be much more effective at moving money between people than the traditional banking system.
That's because they're more consumer-focused, in a sense.
Well, so you're saying, well, you know, banks have to sort of artificially create a mechanism for, you know, moving money from one person to another by capturing your identity and then creating a value store and then creating sort of rails between that. But if you take a natural social network, like family connections, and you use that network to move money, it's a lot more frictionless. So that's the reason for Alipay and Tencent's success in China over the last few years.
Well, the biggest worry for, I think, bank executives now is the entrance of new competitors, which are no longer banks.
Correct.
Alibaba, Amazon again, even Starbucks, Movin, challenger banks, neobanks like Movin. How can one succeed in this new retail banking space? If a CEO were to ask you, I have my digital transformation program in place, but it's not really giving me the returns that I want to see.
So let's take one area, which is the challenger banks that are growing rapidly around the world and the likes of the Alipays and Tencents. What they've done very well is acquire customers at very low cost, digital acquisition, very efficiently. So their ability to onboard a customer scales up very rapidly in the digital world because it's not dependent on you signing a physical piece of paper in a branch. So the first thing I say to CEOs of banks is, can you distribute or sell every product you have in the bank today without a signature on a piece of paper? If you can't do that very basic function, then you can't compete on the rest of the stuff that these guys are doing. And so that's sort of where the battle lines are being drawn right now, digital acquisition. And that's what's going to change market share and sort of change the mix or the dynamic of the sector.
So you wrote a few books about the future of banking, the concept of Bank 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0 to gauge their capability to move into
Correct.
Digital, right? So in your observation, which are some of the banks that have done well in terms of their transformation? And if you can share. What characterizes and why do some banks fail to do so?
Okay, so if you look at sort of that spectrum, the Bank 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0 journey, it sort of comes back to two core elements of influence or change. One is the world moving from physical distribution systems to digital distribution systems. So we've seen this happen in many industries, books, movies, music, taxis and so forth. But on the banking side, what sort of defines our progress is friction, how much friction is involved. So banking being highly regulated has a lot of friction. So that's how I mapped it out. Physical to digital and high friction to low friction engagement on the digital sphere. So that's that trajectory we're on. And so when you look at that and you say, well, what makes a bank that's going to succeed as that trajectory continues, it comes down to really that culture of, are we trying to reduce friction and are we trying to improve the way banks fit in people's lives through the technology? So I always start with the board. Look at the board of a bank, and is the board got do they have technologists on the board? Because you can't really argue with good effect that you're on a digital transformation journey if none of your board members have deep technology experience. So if you look at the likes of Ant Financial, the parent company of Alipay, everyone on the board is a technologist. You look at some of the more traditional incumbents like a HSBC, and they don't have a single technologist on the board. So that is warning signs right there. But you have got some banks that have been pretty good at this. BBVA, I think, has adapted quite well, and they've led from an incumbent perspective in terms of digitization. In the region here, DBS Bank, obviously, Piyush Gupta, I respect him as a lot as a CEO. I think what they did with Digibank in India is a good sort of side experiment for them. And I think some of the Chinese banks have been forced to respond as a result of what's happened with the mobile wallets there as well. In the US, banks like Capital One, USAA, have already digitized most of their product line, I think. But, globally, there's maybe a dozen. It's really tough to find, broad sort of digitization trend in the banking space. I think that says a lot.
So banks are investing so much on revamping their digital IT infrastructure to become more digital. And where does it leave a fintech in terms of, do you see more cooperation with traditional lenders? Or do you think that fintech could possibly pave the way to really changing banking industry?
So there's good arguments for cooperation between fintechs and incumbents. On the fintech side, you get access to scale and revenue that you might take a long time to build yourself. But on the banking side, you get much more efficient deployment of capital. A fintech will be able to produce the same innovation as you in a much shorter period of time at a much lower cost. So there's a good economic argument. The real challenge is clash of cultures. When you get a fintech and an incumbent trying to work together, where it normally sort of hits the brick wall is as soon as you get procurement and legal involved from the traditional banking side, it sort of grinds to a halt. But if you look over the last 20 years at the innovations that have happened in banking, and you map them out, like internet banking, the mobile banking first, mobile wallets, all of these innovations we've had, they've dominantly been done through technology companies and not through incumbents. So what we see right now is the gap is growing. And that's why you see, for example, the challenger banks in the UK, like Revolut, Monzo, Starling, and so forth, now have got quite a strong reputation. Monzo, one in 20 Britons has a Monzo account now. And that has forced the high street banks to really up their game. RBS tried to acquire Monzo, reportedly, a couple of years ago. They failed at that, so now they're producing their own challenger bank. So it shows you the pressure is starting to be applied to the incumbents. I think what we'll end up with in the end is probably sort of a mix. You'll have tech giants who perform a certain function in the market. Fintechs will have specialist expertise in certain areas and plug into that system. And some incumbents at the back end that still run the legacy pipes and so forth. It's not going to be one wins and the other loses.
But in the case of Movin, you've partnered with some traditional lenders.
Correct. TD's a great partner for us in Canada. We're in 8 geographies now with other banks that we partner with, as well as our own direct model in the United States. So we do both. We challenge and we partner.
One final question. You've been in Malaysia for quite often, yes. 2 to 3 times a year, and looking at where we are right now, we are still trying to find our footing in terms of moving up the value chain. And with all this disruption happening, where do you think the direction that Malaysia should take in terms to put us on a sustainable path?
So I think back to 1996 when Malaysia launched the Super Corridor. From a branding perspective, that was brilliant at the time because everyone started talking about it. We started to use it as a sort of a public sector approach, as an example of what government could do in terms of encouraging innovation. I think we need something like that again in Malaysia, but built around artificial intelligence, or maybe like around health tech or something like that. But we need some programs like that that are substantive, but could give sort of a big PR boost to Malaysia as the smart economy of the future.
All right. Thank you so much, Brad, for your time. It's great to have you here
in
Malaysia again. And thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome.